I'm cutting the rope now, Hendrik. Get under his legs. Johannes, the preparator, teetered on the wooden ladder, the knife clutched in his right hand. He heard Hendrik moving into position, the man's bulky frame making the boards of the gallows creak. Are you ready? Hendrik grunted an affirmative. Johannes began to cut. It was only an hour past sunset, but already the streets around them were deserted. It was mid-January and bitterly cold. Johannes expected the canal to freeze sometime in the night. For now, though, he still heard its waters lapping gently at the boat hulls. That and the huffing breath of the horse standing nearby were the only sounds in the settling darkness. Johannes finally managed to saw through the fibers, and all at once the corpse dropped into Hendrik's waiting arms, almost knocking him off his feet. Johannes hurried down the ladder to help, tucking the small blade into his coat. Steady there, I've got his arms. Lift his legs and we'll get him down the steps. Careful how you go. Between the two of them, they maneuvered the body of Aris Kint down from the gallows and onto the waiting cart. Peter, the driver, turned to look. Poor bastard, he said in his gruff, low Dutch. Yes, well, justice is swift. Johannes pulled a handkerchief from an upper pocket and wiped at his fingers. Hendrik patted the horse on the flank. The animal nickered and breathed icy crystals from its nostrils. Johannes had just begun to climb onto the cart for the ride back to the anatomy theater when he saw a light several hundred yards away, swinging slightly and coming closer. It appeared to be a lantern. This was confirmed when Johannes heard footsteps on the cobblestones a moment later. He stepped back off the cart and motioned for Peter to wait. Ho there! A cloaked man approached, his arm raised in greeting. His shuffling gait and pained movement suggested an old man, but Johannes could not yet see his face. His dark figure made an eerie apparition in the flickering pool of lantern light. Johannes raised a hand in return. Is there something you need, good sir? The man limped toward them, pushing back the hood of his cloak. His head was massive and misshapen, and nearly bald aside from a few gray wisps. His face was a rough mass of wrinkles, as though it had been hewn out of soft wood. Forgive me for interrupting your work, gentlemen, he said, nodding to each of them in turn. If I'm correct, you're taking Master Kint to the Surgeon's Guild for dissection. You are correct, Johannes replied. The horse whinnied and clopped its hooves behind him, eager to be on its way. And may I ask what you will do with Master Kint after the dissection is completed? The man held the lantern closer to his face. His eyes had once been blue, but were now filmed over with cataracts. Johannes frowned. Why do you ask this? A favor, sir, if I may ask. The man cackled, his mouth splitting like a rotted fruit, his teeth like blackened stalactites. If your good self has no more use for Master Kint, sir, then might I be allowed to take possession of him? Afterward, I mean. His expression was odd, sycophantic and sly all at once. His milky eyes twinkled. Johannes crossed his arms. Certainly not. Whatever makes you request such a thing? He could hear Hendrik and Peter muttering darkly behind him. I can pay. From among the folds of his cloak, the man produced a small cloth bag that jingled pitifully. Not much, sir, as I'm not a rich man, but a few golden, for something you'll have no further need of. Johannes sighed. The cold was beginning to get to him, his coat was not as heavy as it could have been, and his uncovered fingers were beginning to go numb. Did you know Aris Kint? Was he a relative of yours? My son, yes. The man still held the bag of money out in front of him. Surely you can't refuse a father taking the last remains of his son when you are finished with them. Surely not, sir. He shook the bag, making its contents clink. The sound suddenly seemed loud, as did the slow lapping of the nearby canal. Johannes glanced back at his helpers. Their brows were knitted suspiciously. Hendrik pulled at the canvas that covered the body, then thrust his chin out. Johannes turned back to Kint's alleged father. Keep your money, old man, he spat. If you're so keen on having him, then I suppose it can't do any harm, although I'd prefer it if you kept the transaction to yourself. Of course, sir, I understand. The glee on the man's face was horrible to see, distorting his features into something resembling a gargoyle's. He tucked the money back into his cloak. And when may I? Come to the anatomy theater at just past sundown tomorrow, Johannes said. Do you know the alley that runs parallel with Newmarkt? Yes, sir. Come that way, to the back of Devag. There is a large gray door. Bring your cart there and wait until I come for you, and try not to be seen. The old man pulled his hood back over his face and gave a little bow. Thank you, sir, he said, his eyes nearly white in the glow from the flame. I will be waiting. He turned slowly on his heel and shuffled off into the night, the yellow light from his lantern throwing his hunched shadow across the cobblestones. His jaw set, Johannes checked the body again, securing the canvas with rope. Without a word, he climbed onto the cart and motioned for Peter to drive. Ordinarily, began Dr. Tulp, gripping the forceps in his right hand, we would begin with a study of the viscera, but today I wanted to point out an item of particular interest to me. You will notice I have made the incision here. He indicated the arm of the pale corpse of Aris Kint. And this, he said, lifting a muscle carefully from the arm with the forceps, is the flexor digitorum superficialis. He pulled at the muscle with the forceps, causing the corpse's fingers to flex. Then he demonstrated the motion with his own hand. At that point, the observers crowded more closely around, and Johannes could no longer see what was happening. This did not bother him. He had witnessed many of Dr. Tulp's lessons. Instead, he stood back and surveyed the crowd in the anatomy theater. It was the usual collection of wealthy merchants and the cream of Amsterdam society, all dressed in solemn black for the occasion, their white ruffs crisp in the dimness. Near the front, though, Johannes spotted a lone figure, clad in scruffy brown robes many years out of fashion, with a broad working man's face and reddish hair curling around his ears. The man had a sketchbook and was taking in the scene with great intensity. Johannes thought this must be that artist from Leiden that he'd heard so much about. Dr. Tulp had mentioned commissioning a group portrait, though Johannes wasn't certain what kind of portrait this young scalawag would be able to produce. Still, Master Van Ryn did have a sterling reputation, despite his tender age, and had come at the recommendation of Constantine Huygens himself, so Johannes supposed his doubts were likely groundless. The artist's rough appearance vexed him, though. The man stood out like an elephant in a field of tulips. Dr. Tulp continued his dissection, his voice becoming a sing-song of meaningless sounds to Johannes' ears. The preparator divided his attention between the crowd surrounding the corpse and the earnest face of the artist, who was sketching madly when he wasn't engrossed in the spectacle. As the day wore on, Johannes began to feel warm and uncomfortable, despite the deep chill that pervaded the theater. He never should have promised the cadaver to that old man. What if someone saw him? He could lose his position, even be charged with grave robbing. The subjects of the annual dissections were supposed to be handed over to the secular authorities for disposal. No executed criminal could be interred in hallowed ground. He wondered if that was what Kent's father proposed to do, weasel his son into an undeserved Christian burial. Johannes squared his shoulders. He wasn't going to allow it. When the old man came for the body, he would tell him to go away. Better still, he would tell him that the authorities had already come to claim the remains. The preparator smiled to himself, his discomfort easing. Yes, everything would be all right. When Dr. Tulp had finished his dissection and the crowd had started to disperse, Johannes stepped forward to remove the body from the operating area. The incisions on the corpse had been stitched closed to keep the organs from spilling out during transport, but the cut in the arm was still open and flapped redly. Johannes curled his lip and placed the arm across the man's sunken chest, hiding the worst of the wound. He glanced up and noticed that Dr. Tulp had crossed the theater and was now deep in conversation with the scruffy-looking artist, peering at the sketches and nodding approvingly. Grunting with the effort, Johannes pushed the body on its wheeled wooden cart to the preparation room behind the main chamber. The preparator could still hear buzzing voices from without, but thankfully this back room was empty. He pushed the cart up against the wall, averting his gaze from Aris Kint's naked, bluish carcass. It had started to rot, despite the freezing weather, and Johannes could just catch a whiff of decay when he turned his head. Through the high, narrow windows, the sun was blazing orange. It was nearly sunset. He looked around the room critically. He would have to hide the corpse if he didn't want to give it to the old man, but where? The preparation room was small and cramped, with sturdy wooden tables lining the stone walls. There was a tall cabinet in the corner that afforded possibilities, but when Johannes opened it, he found that it was already packed tight with instruments and supplies. He muttered under his breath, wishing he'd done a better job of keeping the area free of clutter. Well, it was too late to bemoan his poor housekeeping. The old man would be arriving soon, and the body had to be gone. Moving as swiftly as his gangly frame would allow, Johannes pulled a length of canvas from under one of the tables and threw it over Kint's body, tucking the loose ends underneath his slack limbs. Then he wrapped the grisly package with four lengths of rope, keeping the knots fairly loose so they didn't sink into the flesh. That done, he lifted the body from the cart, holding it against him as if he was waltzing with it. The smell this close was nauseating, even though he was used to dealing with corpses. He dragged Kint across the room, heading for the back door. He wished he had thought to bring his own cart around, but someone might have seen him and wondered what he was up to. In any case, he could hide the body in the rubbish piles behind Devag, and then bring his cart around after darkness fell. From there, he would take it to the authorities, dropping it anonymously in front of the building if need be. His back aching with the strain, Johannes undid the latch on the back door and prepared to push it open. It was at that moment that someone knocked, softly but definitively. Before the door had even opened, Willem Kint knew something was amiss. He could hear a distinct grunt, and then the sound of rapid footsteps and large furniture being shifted around. He smiled, his milk-white eyes gleaming. So, the preparator was planning to go back on their agreement. No matter, he had suspected as much. The old man reached into his cloak and fingered the haft of the silver dagger he kept there. Then he reached up and knocked again. At last, the gray door swung open, and the preparator stood there, looking flustered and sweaty in a dour black waistcoat with one button missing. The old man bowed. "I've come as you asked, sir," he said in his most deferential tone, "and I have kept myself unseen." "Ah, so here you are." The preparator's foot tapped on the stone, and he stared down at the old man as if he didn't really see him. "Yes. Well, I'm afraid there's been a bit of confusion."
"Confusion, sir?"
Willem had taken the knife from its leather pouch. He held it in one hand, concealed by a long sleeve. "Yes, the authorities, you see, the ones who normally take possession of the bodies, well, they have..." The preparator glanced over his shoulder. "They've already come. It's most unusual, and I'm sorry that I cannot honor our agreement." The old man smiled and bowed his head. "It certainly isn't any fault of yours, sir," he said. Then he arranged his face to suggest sorrow. "I would have liked to see my boy at least once more, though, sir. Even though he was a thief and a brute, he was still my son." "Well, I do apologize." The preparator's fingers twitched on the door latch. "You did what you could, sir, and I do thank you." Willem held out his hand, the one that didn't contain the dagger. "I'll not trouble you again." The relief was visible on the preparator's face. He reached out to grasp the old man's hand. With speed and agility shocking in a man so ancient, Willem clasped the preparator's hand and pulled the younger man down toward him, simultaneously slicing upward with the dagger and connecting with the flesh of the preparator's chest. The flow of blood was immediate and hot. While the younger man was still reeling from the attack, Willem threw him to the ground and stepped over his writhing body into the preparation room. The area was small, and Willem could see immediately where the corpse lay, crammed haphazardly beneath one of the big wooden tables. His sandals slapping on the stones, he crossed the room and knelt to drag the body free. He had been outside Devag for a while, watching the comings and goings. He knew most of the observers had gone, but a few still lingered, so he would have to work quickly. The preparator moaned, but not loudly. Willem ignored him, focused on his task. Aris Kint had been a thin man in life, but in death he seemed to have gained several pounds. The old man struggled mightily, pulling his canvas-wrapped burden across the floor. His cart was just outside in the alley. He didn't have far to go. As he stepped past the preparator, the younger man reached out and grabbed his ankle, but the grip was weak. The man was dying. Willem shook his hand off and bent down to lift the corpse. At last, after much effort, the old man had succeeded at getting Aris onto his cart. It was now full dark outside, and the road around Devag was deserted. Before he mounted behind the horse, Willem used his foot to push the preparator's limp body back into the building, closing the door on it with a massive heave. There was a thick pool of blood cooling on the stones, but the old man didn't think anyone would notice it until morning. His clothes were another matter, but he couldn't worry about that just now. Nodding to himself, he climbed onto his cart and urged his horse forward. When he finally slowed, he had come nearly 2 miles from the center of Amsterdam and was in one of the worst sections of the city. The houses were caked with filth. Half-naked ragamuffins ran the streets at all hours of the night. The only buildings with lanterns burning were the pubs, which spilled noise and drunken revelers into the crooked, narrow alleys. Willem had not lit his lantern on the journey here in order to keep a lower profile. Now he was glad he had not. He traveled in darkness, keeping to the shadows, avoiding the few shady figures he spotted walking along the open and refuse-clotted sewers. He finally arrived at a gray boarding house, which had a torch burning above the door. He drew his cart even with the entrance and climbed down from his perch. He thought he could smell the fetid odor coming off Aris's corpse, but it might have been sewage or any number of other horrible things that Willem didn't care to imagine. There was a long silence after he'd knocked at the door. For a moment, his heart dropped, thinking the woman was not here or had forgotten their appointment. Then he heard the clank of a metal key in the lock, and the door opened a crack. A yellowed eye peered out at him. "Brought it, have you?" a voice croaked. Willem gestured to the cart in lieu of answering. The door opened wider, revealing a small, hunched woman dressed in several layers of ragged wool shawls. Her long white hair was gnarled and tangled, emerging wildly from beneath a faded red cloth wrapped around her head. She raised a wizened hand and beckoned with one skeletal finger. Willem lifted the corpse from the cart, still wrapped in its canvas shroud. The woman stepped back and let him carry it into the front room of the boarding house, which was lit by a single lantern and contained no furniture except a single wooden chair and a battered cooking pot sitting on a hearth that looked as though it hadn't been lit in quite some time. As there was nowhere to put the body down, the old man simply laid it gently on the floor. The stones were as cold as ice. He could feel them through his thin shoes. "You pay?" The woman was standing directly behind him, her breath rattling and stinking of old meat. Her hand was extended like the claw of a bird of prey. Willem dug in his cloak and produced his cloth bag. It only held a few golden, all that he possessed in the world. He shook the coins into the woman's hand. She stared at them as though they represented the riches of a sultan. A moment later, she had secreted them somewhere amid her shawls. "You wait upstairs," she commanded, pointing to a rickety ladder in the corner that Willem had not noticed. "Am I not to witness it then?" he asked, drawing himself up to full height. "No, I must do alone. You may come down after." She chewed at her lips with her blackened gums. "Go now. I call for you when it is finished." Defeated, Willem glanced once more at the body of his son, nearly shapeless under the canvas, and made his way toward the ladder. Dr. Nicolaes Tulp ascended the stairs at Davag up to the living quarters above the anatomy theater. Master Van Ryn, the painter, had been staying there for the past few days while he worked on the commission, but this was the first time that Dr. Tulp had gone up to check on his progress. He had heard that Rembrandt worked quickly, so he hoped there would be some substantial progress to see. He knocked discreetly, and at Rembrandt's call he entered. The room was small but pleasant, with a large window looking out at the Newmarkt, which was bustling at this time of day. Rembrandt himself stood before his canvas, a brush in his mouth, his diminutive frame draped in his trademark brown robes. He looked, Dr. Tulp thought with some amusement, like a particularly unkempt monk. As he watched, the painter leaned forward and scraped at the canvas with the end of his brush handle. "Good day, Master Van Ryn," Dr. Tulp hailed, removing his round-crowned hat, an emblem of his status. "I hope I'm not interrupting anything, but I was curious to see how you were coming along." "I'd be honored, sir," Rembrandt said with a little bow, backing away from the painting so that Dr. Tulp would have a closer look at it. "Why, this is extraordinary." Dr. Tulp leaned close, his nose almost touching the canvas. "The composition is most wonderful. I've never seen another like it." "Thank you for saying so, sir. I did wish to capture a certain movement, in addition to focusing attention on your good self, sir." "Well, you've certainly done that," Dr. Tulp said, obviously pleased. "You've worked on this a great deal, I see. It looks almost finished." "Yes, it does need some more work in some areas, such as here on the arm of the corpse. My sketches of it were not as detailed as they could have been, I fear. Perhaps distance was a factor there, sir." Rembrandt had picked up another brush and was drawing the stiff bristles between his fingers. "Well, I have plenty of anatomical texts if you need a reference. They're in my study just down the hall there. You may borrow them any time you like. The door's never locked." "Thank you, sir. That would be most helpful." "Indeed." Dr. Tulp took one last appraising glance at the painting and then turned to leave, placing his hat back upon his head. "I must say that I'm happy that Master Huygens recommended you for this position. I think this work will be a credit to you as well as to me and my profession." "I hope so, sir." Rembrandt bowed again, his brush still in his hand, his robe spattered with paint. "Good day, then." Dr. Tulp stepped over the threshold, then remembered something and turned back. "I say, Master Van Ryn, did you hear of that awful business last night in the Leidestraat? The murder?" Rembrandt looked up, startled. "No. Who was murdered?" "Damned if I can remember his name. Main executioner he was. Ironic that, isn't it?" He chuckled a little, then coughed. "Well, not safe to walk the streets at night, sad to say. In any case, I'm sure the person responsible will be brought to justice. In the meantime, he tipped his hat with his hand. Again, good day, Master Van Ryn. Good day, sir. Dr. Tulp left the studio and closed the door quietly behind him. Willem Kent sat in the room's only chair and stared at his son in the flickering lamplight. He could hardly believe what the woman had done, even now, 24 hours later. Aris was slumped against the far wall, his eyes glazed but open and presumably seeing, his white fingers beating a nervous rhythm on the knees of his tattered trousers. He didn't appear to be breathing, but he lived, by hell. The old man crossed himself, knowing that this small piety could not atone for the abomination he had wrought. "Tonight, again?" said the woman, who was bent over the hearth, stirring an evil-smelling broth in her cooking pot. "Yes," Willem said. "The executioner is dead. Tonight he will revenge himself upon the sheriff who convicted him, and perhaps upon the man who fingered him for the crime, if he can find him." The woman cackled. "Your son will live until his revenge is complete, no matter how long it may take." "Yes, I understand that," Willem said. Aris was looking dumbly back and forth between his father and the old woman, understanding little or nothing. Willem's heart broke, seeing his son's emotionless face hanging there in the dimness. This was not his son resurrected, as much as he would have liked to think so. It was merely a body animated by bloodlust, by a rough kind of justice. Willem peered through the window and saw the moon, full and orange, floating above the horizon. Soon, he thought to himself. The woman poured her reeking concoction into two bowls and handed one to Willem. He held his breath and sipped, trying not to gag. It didn't taste as bad as it smelled, but that wasn't saying a great deal. He considered taking the bowl to Aris to feed him, but he already knew it would be pointless. The thing that Aris had become was no longer human, and no longer needed human nourishment. When the soup was gone and the lantern had burned down a little further, Aris began to stir, getting clumsily to his feet as though he was a marionette on a string. Willem stood also, keeping well back. The woman had said that these specimens were sometimes erratic and might turn on those who were helping them. Aris, though, seemed not to notice his father at all, and instead turned his head toward the door, making his way toward it with deliberate shuffling steps. The woman nodded, and Willem began to follow, keeping a safe distance. Once they were away from the house, Willem stepped up his pace, trailing Aris by about 6 feet. The streets were dark, but the moon provided ample light, and Willem had no trouble keeping his ghostly son in view. The night before, Aris had headed west toward Lidestrat, but tonight he turned east, trudging along with a single-minded purpose. The city seemed silent around them. The sound of the corpse's footfalls on the cobblestones was blasphemous. The old man struggled to keep up over the long trek. Aris was tireless and kept a constant pace. The moon had risen farther in the sky by the time they turned into a wide avenue lined with respectable houses. Lamps blazed on every corner, but the street was eerily devoid of life. Aris mounted the steps of a particularly fine house with whitewashed shutters and stone lions flanking the entrance. The door was dark green and had a gold knocker. Aris, however, did not knock, but simply opened the door and stepped inside. Willem, as he had done on the previous night, waited outside in the street, pulling his cloak around him to fend off the cold. He heard the sounds. As much as he wanted to stop his ears, he would not, because he knew he must participate in some small way. He must accept a modicum of responsibility. He told himself that the sheriff was getting what he deserved. He had executed an innocent man, after all. As true as this was, it did not make hearing the sounds of his death any easier. It seemed both an eternity and a matter of seconds before Aris emerged from the house, his hastily assembled clothes, since he'd come from the anatomy theater naked, soaked with red. His face was as slack and emotionless as ever, his eyes like two silver coins glinting in the night. The noises the sheriff had made in dying had apparently awakened others. Willem could see candles being lit in windows around the street. His heart hammering in his chest, he gestured for Aris to hurry, not having any idea if his son could understand him. As they made their way up the avenue and back into the darkness, he thought he could hear shouting and barking dogs. He quickened his pace to a trot, which was as fast as his bones would move these days. Aris was still a few steps behind, but he caught up easily and passed his father, loping along as though he hadn't a care in the world. Willem hoped that the one murder would be enough for one evening, but this hope was dashed when Aris turned, not toward the boarding house, but south toward the Moritzgade. His legs aching, Willem followed. The second man was drinking in a pub nearly half a mile from the sheriff's house. Aris stood outside and stared in with a strange, stupid gaze, his black hair falling limply across his forehead. Willem stood in the shadows a few yards away, shivering in his thin cloak. He didn't know how long they would have to wait, but the old man hoped it wasn't long enough for him to freeze to death. Fortunately, it was no more than half an hour before the man staggered out, alone, into the darkened alley beside the pub. He burped, then laughed loudly before bracing himself against the wall with one hand. His piss steamed as it spattered onto the stones. He sang a snatch of song, nearly fell, pissing on his shoes in the process, then righted himself. Willem was almost glad to see the man in this state. At least he wouldn't comprehend what was happening to him. Aris approached from behind, and he was nearly upon his victim before the drunken man turned. He didn't seem surprised in the least, but murmured something that sounded vaguely companionable. Aris reached for him and closed a long, thin hand around the man's neck. The drunk's eyes got bigger, and he opened his mouth to protest, but all that came out was a beer-smelling belch. Aris squeezed, and Willem heard something pop. The man fell to the ground, groaning. Aris bent over him like a vulture, his claw-like hands tearing at his clothes and skin. The man's cries grew weaker and weaker as Aris leaned closer and closer, going at the man with fingers and teeth. At some point, Aris must have severed an artery, because blood sprayed against the alley wall, mingling with the cooling urine and producing a noxious aroma of copper and ammonia. Willem turned away, but he could still hear the wet sounds of flesh being torn from bone, the sounds of bones being crushed by teeth. The sounds from the pub seemed far away, part of another world. When Aris had finished, there was little left of the man but blood and a pile of shredded rags, smeared here and there with gobbets of skin and fat. Willem fought the urge to vomit, stepping out of the polluted alley and breathing deeply of the frigid night air. Somehow his own killing of that officious preparator had not bothered the old man nearly as much as seeing the same crime perpetrated by his only son. He wasn't sure why this should be, but he couldn't deny it. Aris appeared a moment later, looking like a parody of a painted devil, crimson from head to toe. Sighing, Willem removed his topmost cloak and threw it over his son's shoulders. The boy's face was still a fright, but perhaps no one would notice in the dark. His teeth chattering, the old man followed as the corpse shambled in a northerly direction, back toward the boarding house. The three murders had been carried out. Justice had been served. Willem was saddened by the fact that his son would now be well and truly lost to him, while it was true that this mute monstrosity before him was no replacement for the real living Aris. The corpse still bore his son's outer trappings, and this, Willem reasoned, was enough to stir sentimental feelings within him. When morning came, he thought, he would lay Aris Kint to rest with the knowledge that he had avenged his wrongful execution, and may God forgive him for that. The moon had passed the halfway point in the firmament, meaning dawn was but a few short hours away. The cold was like many tiny knives biting into his flesh, and the walk had all but exhausted every ounce of energy he possessed. He would be glad to get back to the boarding house, even glad to sip at a bowl of the woman's foul stew. The house was surely not far now. But it seemed that Aris was not walking toward the boarding house after all. He had turned again, this time to the northwest, toward the center of Amsterdam. As soon as the old man realized this, his heart began thumping again. There was no one else responsible for the execution, he was certain of it. And the woman had promised that Aris would only live as long as it took to take revenge on those responsible for his death. So what was happening now? Willem went after him, mystified, forgetting about his tired legs and his frozen fingers. Aris seemed as unconcerned as ever, moving deliberately along the streets, not feeling the cold at all. Before long, the old man thought he could hear the lap of the canal in the distance. Moments later, a large stone building that looked like a fortress loomed before them. Without pausing to look or consider, Aris made his meandering way toward it, and Willem hurried to follow. Rembrandt had been sleeping, but woke when he thought he heard a noise on the stairs outside his room. He lay on his cot, straining to hear. No one else was supposed to be in the building at this time of night. Normally he didn't mind the solitude, but the stories about the murder had stoked his already active imagination. He had almost decided that the sound had been a mouse and that he should try to go back to sleep when it came again, a dragging, furtive sound, definitely made by something much larger than a rodent. He sat up and felt for his cloak. The moonlight was streaming in the window, providing just enough light to make his easel look like a hulking beast with spindly legs. He pulled his cloak around himself and lit the lantern on the table near the cot. The room appeared as ordinary as it had been when he'd retired to bed, but now the sound was louder, a scraping right outside the door. Frightened, he lifted the lantern and crept across the room. "Who's there?" he called. There was no answer, but then he thought he heard a knock, albeit one that sounded somehow meaty and damp. He shuddered. "Who is it?" There came another sound, labored breathing and a quick patter of footsteps. "I'm sorry to disturb you, sir. I'm not sure why we've come." Relieved to hear a human voice at last, Rembrandt approached the door, lantern in hand, and opened it. For a moment, he didn't understand what he was seeing, and when he did, he nearly dropped the lantern. "What the devil?" "Sorry again, sir." An old man in woefully inadequate clothing appeared behind the horror that stood swaying upon the doorstep. "This is my son. I suppose he wishes to see you." Rembrandt stepped back into the room, glad to move away from the thin, pale monster who appeared to be covered in blood and who smelled like a slaughterhouse. The old man came into the room first, worming his way around the younger man, who didn't move from the threshold. After a long moment, he staggered into the room. The old man closed the door behind him. Rembrandt had nothing in the way of refreshment to offer the pair, so simply motioned for them to sit on the cot he had recently vacated. The old man sat wearily, but the son just stood, his shoulders slumped. His gaze seemed to be fixed upon the painting that Rembrandt had nearly completed, the one that he hoped would make his fortune in Amsterdam. As the artist watched, the savage-looking man hobbled over to the canvas and stopped a few feet in front of it, tilting his head to one side. "He won't damage it, will he?" Rembrandt whispered, but the old man just shrugged and shook his head. The silence of the room was broken only by the harsh rasp of the old man's breathing. At last, the younger man stirred and turned away from the painting. For a brief second, understanding seemed to flicker in his silver coin eyes, and he stared at Rembrandt as though trying to remember where he might have seen him before. The artist felt his blood run cold at the scrutiny. When the man moved, Rembrandt stepped back, his arms half raised to ward off an attack, but the monster simply shuffled forward and sat at the table that served as Rembrandt's dining area. He then flopped his pale arm onto the wooden tabletop, letting the incision made by Dr. Nikolai's tulp flap open, exposing the muscles and nerves beneath. The artist gasped, recognizing the wound immediately. Surely this could not be the same man he had witnessed on the dissection table just a few short days before. As he studied the features, the low, heavy brow, the slightly upturned nose, the scruff of beard at the chin, he knew for certain that this man had been the unwitting model at the center of his latest painting, the anatomy lesson of Dr. Nikolai's tulp. The man was sitting still, as though waiting for something. The wound on his arm still looked fresh, and Rembrandt remembered how Dr. Tulp had pulled at the flexor digitorum superficialis with his forceps, causing the corpse's fingers to flex. Rembrandt had made several sketches of the action, but he hadn't been able to get it exactly right. It was this that was holding up the satisfactory completion of the painting. Then, understanding dawned. Moving as quickly as he could, he lit the remaining three lanterns in the room. The light was far from adequate, but it would have to do. He pulled his easel closer to the table and added linseed oil to the pigments he'd ground before going to bed. "Is this right?" he wanted to ask the dead man, but he knew it was, so he didn't ask. Loading his brush with red lake, he began laying in the detail on the corpse's arm, sketching in the muscles with long, thick strokes, then going back over them with more refined movements. As he worked, he heard the old man come up behind him, his breath warm on the artist's neck. He pointed at the canvas. "That's my boy there," the old man said. It was almost a sigh. "Yes." It was all Rembrandt could say. There were so many questions he wanted to ask the old man about what had happened, but he dared not speak them out loud. One did not question a miracle. Just before the moon set behind the horizon, Rembrandt stood back and surveyed his painting, a smile creeping across his ample face. The muscles of Aris Kent's arm now lay exposed and glimmering and perfect, laid open forever for the entire world to see. The old man leaned in and reached toward the image, his fingers trembling just inches away from its surface, and then he brought his fingers to his lips and held them there. Rembrandt thought he saw tears sparkling in the old man's eyes. "It is finished." The artist directed this statement to Aris Kent, who still sat at the table as though he would never move, his face as blank as the face of a Greek statue. He did not look at the painting, but simply lifted his arm from the tabletop, then rose from his chair. It was time for him to go. The old man clasped Rembrandt's arm. Somehow he remembered. It was all he could manage, but it was all that was necessary. Rembrandt nodded his head, not speaking, but saying volumes with his silence. The dead man and his devoted father made a bedraggled parade toward the door of Rembrandt's temporary studio. The old man opened the door and let his son walk out before him. Then he turned. "Thank you, sir," he said. He seemed to remember something then, for his face went distant and melancholy, but the emotion was gone in an instant. He bowed his bald head and then disappeared into the shadows of the outer hall. Rembrandt stood and watched the door for a long time after they had gone. He glanced at his painting again. Aris Kent's body seemed to glow with a kind of inner light, a humanity that emanated from him, making him more than just a corpse being dissected upon a slab. Rembrandt laughed a little sadly. Dr. Tulp would likely view himself as the star attraction of this portrait, but the artist would always know where its true heart lay. I suppose that I was, technically, dead before I hit the ground, although I can't say that for sure. I don't know exactly when the line between life and death was crossed, and perhaps I never will. But the funny thing was that even though I had died, was in the past tense as it were, I still managed to feel the impact of my bloody sack of flesh against the floorboards, hear the thump that was muffled by an inch of brown shag carpeting. Scarier yet, I could see Celine standing over me, with the smeared and sparkling blade sprouting from her paper-white fist. Her mouth was twisted, her chest heaved. The blood on the knife perfectly matched the twin scarlet blotches that stained her otherwise colorless cheeks like Rorschach ink blots. Celine was staring at me, and I felt it unwise to alert her to my peculiar condition. She had plunged that pig sticker right into my throat after all, and had every right to expect me to have shuffled off my mortal coil. Who knew whether another good stab wouldn't finish the job? I lay perfectly still. My eyeballs were drying out. When she looked away for a second, I blinked and then glanced to my right. The golden vial winked seductively, just millimeters from my fingers. It must have dropped and rolled as I fell. Celine's eagle eyes rested on me again and I froze. She swooped down from her great height and snatched the vial up in her hand. I could smell her familiar aroma as she parted the air above me, all lilies and apples and the vague musk of adrenaline. She gave the vial a cursory once-over, then replaced the cap and secreted it in her pocket. My heart sank. It must have been the blood, of course. Not my blood, but the blood in the vial. I didn't think any of it had passed my lips, but a drop of it must have, somehow, before Celine had come howling into the room like a bladed banshee. It was the blood that had kept me alive, even as my own red life force spurted in great dark fountains from the wound in my neck. I almost laughed. It really works, I thought. All that time when I thought Celine was just kidding around or crazy or both. I tried to remain still. A thousand thoughts were stumbling through my head, tripping over one another. Why hadn't I believed her sooner? Why hadn't I waited until she was out? And then, thundering into my brain in big neon letters as red as the blood, I have to drink the rest. Yes, I would have to. For if the molecule of that magical elixir that I had swallowed could do this, imagine what drinking the entire vial would do. I tried to be still, but my whole body was vibrating. I had to plan. Celine was standing there like stone. She was thinking of what she was going to do with me. I had to act fast. I decided, if I moved, quickly, unexpectedly, I could use her few seconds of surprise to my advantage, wresting knife and vial from her precarious possession. I didn't know if I would be able to best her, not in this condition, but I had to try. I bunched my muscles to spring. Celine turned sharply and left the room. My muscles relaxed. Shit, where is she going? I could hear her white pumps pounding down the stairs, hear the door from the kitchen to the garage opening and closing. I stayed put, playing possum. My heart would have been racing if it hadn't stopped beating altogether. The carpet around me was a mushy soup of gore. I tried to ignore the uncomfortable squish beneath my back and arms. When Celine reappeared at the threshold of the bedroom, her cheeks were redder than ever, and her eyes glittered like a wolverine's. I know it sounds stupid, but I still loved her. She was beautiful there, framed in the doorway. Everything about her was white. White dress, white skin, and that peculiar silvery hair that always reminded me of fine spider silk. An avenging angel, I thought. Then I looked down. Celine's hand, the one that had conveyed the life-ending blow, was now encircling the pockmarked handle of the axe from the garage. Her other hand clutched a roll of black garbage bags. I nearly screamed. What the fuck was I supposed to do now? Lie here and let her chop me to pieces? She positioned herself over me, bringing the axe up over her head, hefting its weight in both of her delicate hands. And that was when I struck. She was startled, that much was obvious. My body sprang from the floor like a bloody jack-in-the-box, grabbing at her whiteness with scarlet fingers. She shrieked and jumped back, almost falling but catching herself. The axe split the atoms just above my head. I'm sure I heard the hairs there cry out in mortal terror. I staggered to my feet, reaching for her. I felt weak and ill, but not as bad as I expected, all things considered. Celine backed up a step. Her shock had morphed into fury. I could see it in the set of her jaw. She meant to finish me, this woman I had loved for more than 5 years. "I told you, James," she said, her voice tight but otherwise as pleasant as ever. "Why didn't you listen to me?" "Give me the vial," I said. I walked toward her with my arms outstretched, a shambling Frankenstein's monster. "I can't do that," she said. She swung the axe again. I ducked clumsily, but it caught me on the ear. I felt nothing, and I didn't have any blood left in my body to gush forth from the wound. I kept shuffling toward her. "You've already ruined everything for me," she said. "You already drank some of the blood. I can't leave you like this. It has to be finished." "You can't kill me," I said. I didn't know that for certain, but I said it with defiance. "I can, and I will," she hissed, although she didn't look so sure of herself. She doesn't even know, I thought. Some almighty keeper of ancient wisdom she turned out to be. I swiped at her, clawing at the pocket that held the life-giving fluid, but she was ready for me. Stepping back, she brought the axe down full upon my left shoulder, nearly severing the arm in one blow. It didn't hurt, not really. She swung the axe once, twice, three times, until both my arms lay like grotesque flesh-colored snakes upon the carpet. "She's gonna have a lot of cleaning up to do," I thought crazily. Without the use of my arms, my body pinwheeled off balance, and I crashed to the floor on my side. That was the only opportunity Celine needed. I had a brief second where my entire field of vision was annihilated by a huge silver blade, like an absurdly realistic 3D movie, and then I was looking at the rest of my abused form from a few feet across the floor. I could see the ragged red stump where my head and neck had parted company. "You bitch," I tried to scream, but of course my severed vocal cords offered nothing but an inaudible gurgle. I tried to give her a withering stare, but it's very difficult to look intimidating when you're the same size, shape, and usefulness as a roughed-up bowling ball. She looked at me. She was sweating and quite mad, and seemingly enjoying herself. Then she began hacking away at my legs. They proved a tougher job than the arms had been, but she eventually got them off. My body now lay scattered in 6 pieces like an anatomical jigsaw, and still I lived. Celine knelt down near my head, peering into my eyes. "I'm sorry about this, James," she said, as if she'd done nothing more earth-shattering than forgetting to pick up the dry cleaning. "You did bring it on yourself, though." "Fat fucking chance," I wanted to say, but my moving lips produced no sound. I mean, sure, I had disobeyed her explicit instructions, and sure, she had told me time and time again that she would have to kill me if I ever meddled in her affairs, but I'd never taken her seriously. My mouth snapped shut. It was no use making excuses now, was it? She unfurled one of the garbage bags and shoved a leg into it, then the other, and then she did the same for my arms and torso. Soon she had a small pile of bags that would have appeared as innocuous as lawn clippings if not for the reddish-brown stains covering nearly every square inch of the room. Finally, she unrolled the last bag. "Goodbye, James," she said, and picked my poor head up by the hair and dropped it in with a swish. Everything was dark for a little while. A short time later, I felt the rumble of a motor beneath my cheek, waking me from a fitful doze. I couldn't see a damn thing, but I deduced that I was in the spotless trunk of Celine's pearl-gray Oldsmobile. I felt yielding flesh around me, an elbow poking out here, a couple of toes there. All my worldly parts in a neat little pile beneath my head like a pillow. What the hell is going to become of me, I wondered. Will I live forever in this pitiful state? What a depressing thought. It was hot in the trunk, and sweat started trickling into my eyes. Of course, I couldn't wipe it away. All I could do was blink and grit my teeth at the rotten injustice of it all. The rumble of the motor stopped, and the darkness suddenly lifted. I could see a kind of diffused glow through the plastic. Celine had opened the trunk. She was rooting around in the body parts as if she was picking out produce. I wondered if I could bite her, but she was too quick. She pulled free one of the bags. It looked small, maybe one of the arms, then slammed the trunk, engulfing me in blackness again. After a few moments, I'm quite sure I heard a splashing noise. So that's her game, I thought, distributing my wretched pieces far and wide, trying to cover her tracks. Well, let her. I'll get that vial somehow. I don't know why I was so sure, but I was. As I rode along, I thought of Celine, of how I was going to get her back. In a way, even though it sounds bizarre, I didn't blame her for all this. She had, to her credit, told me about the vial from the very beginning. I hadn't believed her, of course. Who would have? When a person tells you that she is the latest in a long line of guardians of the blood of the great god Osiris, and that the blood has the power to resurrect the dead, just as Osiris himself was resurrected by Isis, well, you tend to think that person might have a screw loose somewhere. And yet, all through our 5 years of marriage, that vial was always at the back of my mind. I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. It was stupid, of course. It couldn't possibly do what Celine claimed, but still. My curiosity had grown with each passing year, and in the end, just like one of Bluebeard's ill-fated brides, I gave into it with fatal results. I would have sighed if my windpipe had still been connected to my lungs. A few miles later, another body part was retrieved and discarded, and a few miles later, another. Sometimes I heard a splash, and sometimes I heard a metallic bang, like something heavy hitting the bottom of a dumpster. Soon my head was all that was left of me in the trunk, and after a while, when it had presumably grown dark outside, I could no longer see any light through the sheet of my plastic prison, I felt my head being lifted from the damp carpeting and cradled in Celine's slim arms. Was that tenderness she was handling me with, or was it just my imagination? I opened my mouth and bared my teeth, but I couldn't turn to grab her. She held me too tightly. All I got was a mouthful of plastic for my pains. And then came a sensation that I'm sure no living person has ever experienced. There was a strangely exhilarating feeling of flight as my head was hurled through the air, unattached and free. I felt weightless. Then came a sharp slap as I hit the surface of the water. I sank, and even though the water pressed in around me, I found I could still breathe and felt no discomfort. That was something, at least. The lake, or whatever it was, wasn't very deep, because I settled at the bottom almost immediately, the soft sand receiving my neck stump like a nest receives an egg. It was very quiet. I still couldn't see, but soon I began to feel tiny nips at the plastic, as if many small fish were investigating me, checking to see if I was worth eating. It tickled, and I tried to move to frighten them away, but I couldn't. I just blinked in the silence. What now? I don't know how much time passed. The damn fish had had their way with me, nibbling through the plastic so that I could now see through it in places. The water was dirty, peppered with pieces of bag and flesh. I had pretty much come to terms with the fact that I was just going to sit here and be eaten by fish until the end of time, or until someone found my head, whichever came first. But then something wonderful happened. It was morning. I knew that because of the way the sunlight shimmered on the surface of the water, filtering down among the ripples. I awoke to the usual gang of fish faces staring back at me with their weird, unblinking eyes, their little mouths opening and closing in perfect unison, as though they were singing a hymn. I furrowed my brow at them, which was all I could do, and which naturally had no effect on them at all. And then I heard something moving, something big. All the muscles in my head stiffened. The first thing that sprang to mind was an alligator. The ornery reptiles were not unknown in these parts. I felt less than enthusiastic about finding out what it might be like to live in the belly of one of the beasts, even for the few days it would take him to digest me. I struggled to move, to roll to one side, anything, but as ever, I was stuck fast, buried to the chin in shifting layers of silt and mud. I closed my eyes. Please let him think I'm a rock, I thought. The big thing was coming closer, moving the water in great undulating waves, disturbing the lake bottom. I couldn't stand it anymore. I opened my eyes. The fish were gone, and sitting there right in front of me, dappled in the early morning sunlight, was my torso. It looked not much the worse for wear, just a few patches of skin missing here and there. It couldn't have been in the water. It had likely been one of the lucky pieces to be consigned to dumpster land. It sat there, the empty neck stump seeming to consider me, as though struggling to recognize a distant relative. And then it inched closer, and I found my head was moving of its own accord, digging itself out of the mud. My eyes rolled wildly, and my mouth flapped open and closed in an impression of one of the fish. My head was sliding towards my body, and then I realized that the blood must have been doing this. It was bringing all my scattered parts back together. I was ecstatic. My head and torso met and fused. I laughed like a madman. It was only a few seconds later that I noticed my other parts crawling through the water toward me like enormous sea slugs. Each approached with trepidation, and then sidled up to fuse with the rest of me. I can't begin to describe the joy I felt. Some of the pieces had fared better than others, though all were in various stages of decay, and all had black flecks of plastic still attached. My right arm looked the worst. The skin had gone gray, and bone was showing through in places. But that was all right. When my body was whole again, I found I could move freely with my rotted and damaged limbs, just as I had when I was alive and healthy. Triumphantly, I sat up in the water. I wanted to scream to the universe. I had cheated death. I was immortal. I got to my feet. The water was only up to my shins. The fish swam near me, uncertainly, and I kicked them away with an enormous splash, giggling all the while. I stood like that for a few minutes before realizing that I was, of course, naked as the day I was born. My clothes had fallen or been eaten away. Well, that was all right, too. I could find something to wear. I took stock of my desiccated body. Preferably something with long sleeves, I thought, and maybe a hood. I ducked into some underbrush. I had no idea where I was. Nothing looked familiar. I could hear the rush of a highway somewhere nearby, but I couldn't see anything other than trees and grass clearings. Carefully, I crawled out of the bushes and peered around. Maybe if I wasn't far from civilization, someone would come down to the water eventually. Someone whose clothes I could steal. As I waited, I became aware of a peculiar sound. It was a kind of faraway hum, sinuous and hypnotic under the roar of the traffic. I cocked my half-eaten ear toward it. It sounded like a voice, whispered but perfectly audible. It was calling me, I was sure of it. I couldn't tell if it was a man's voice or a woman's, but not obeying the call was apparently not an option. My body began moving of its own accord toward the voice. Helpless, I simply relaxed and let my reattached limbs lead me where they would. I'm not sure how far I walked. Strangely, no one seemed to notice my nudity, or if they did, they didn't react to it. The streets were fairly lonely anyway, with what seemed like hours going by between one car and the next. I walked and walked, dropping little pieces of flesh along the roadside, leaving a trail like Hansel and Gretel's breadcrumbs. It got dark and then light again, and still I walked. I wasn't tired at all. My bare feet didn't even blister or chafe on the blacktop. It was growing dark again when I saw a car pulled over to the side of the road up ahead. It was dusk, and I squinted as I approached it. I was about 100 feet away when the realization dawned that the car was familiar. It was a pearl gray Oldsmobile. My jaw clenched. The voice was calling me toward it. The blood was calling me back to Celine. She came out of the woods. I guess she'd gone in there for a pee or something. She was pretty surprised to see me. I stopped just behind the car. She stood there staring. "Hello, Celine," I said. It seemed appropriate. "How did you find me?" she asked. She was edging toward the car as she spoke. "Don't know much about that blood of yours, do you?" I said. She frowned. Closer to the car, closer. "I know enough." Her hand met the car door, felt for the handle. "It called me," I said. "It wants me to drink the rest of it. I have to have the rest of it." "You don't want it, James." She fumbled for her keys. "And I can't give it to you." I took a step toward her. "I wasn't expecting you to give it to me." She got the door open, then turned, waving the keys at me like a weapon. "Get away from me." I lunged at her. One of the keys sunk into the soft flesh of my cheek. I just laughed, my hands encircling her arms. She screamed, but there was no one around to hear her. "Where is it?" I asked. She pressed her lips together, closed her eyes, and shook her head. She wasn't going to tell me. Well, it didn't matter. She still had it with her, of that much I was certain. She was squirming and punching at me with her useless fists. The song of the blood in my ears was deafening, drowning out her screams. "Finish her," it said. My fingers crept up to her throat. I did feel a moment of regret as I snapped her neck. Only a moment. Her white form crumpled at my feet. "Sorry, Celine," I thought. I kicked her aside and climbed into the car. I felt an immature stab of glee in the fact that I was getting rotted flesh all over the pristine interior of her car. I looked in the glove compartment, and there was the vial, right there on top of the Oldsmobile owner's manual. I snorted. "Guardian of the blood of the great god Osiris. Way to go, Celine." I pulled the stopper and drank. The blood was warm and smooth going down, like hot chocolate with cream. It was singing my praises all the way down to my stomach. I licked my lips, rested back on the gray upholstery. I waited. I didn't wait long. The sky went dark outside as though a black curtain had suddenly been pulled across the atmosphere. I looked through the windows, frightened and exhilarated. I was changing. I could feel it. I climbed out of the car. The darkness wasn't like night at all. I don't know if I can really describe it. There were no stars, and the black was tempered with a sort of eerie red glow that emanated from nowhere and everywhere. I spun around. I felt odd, but when I looked down at myself, my body hadn't changed. It was still half decayed and misaligned, like a badly sewn doll. I was confused. Surely it wouldn't stay like that forever. I gripped the car door with my flaking hands. I could feel wisps all around me, like smoke or silk or tiny threads caressing my skin. I jumped and tried to brush them away. All around me, in the black, were blacker shapes, black on black, moving across the ground, flying through the air. I was terrified now. Then I looked down at Celine. As I watched, a dark shape fingered its way out of her, as though her shadow had taken leave of her material body. The Celine thing seemed to stare at me with its faceless face. "James," it said. A high shriek escaped my throat. "What are you? What's going on?" "I told you that you didn't want the blood, James," the shadow said. "Why? Where am I?" A gurgling chuckle issued from somewhere amid the black wisps. "In the underworld, your new home." My muscles tightened. "But I thought I was supposed to be immortal." "Oh, you will be," the Celine thing said. It hovered above her body like a bad dream. The great god Osiris was the lord of the underworld, but now he can move on. You've taken his place. "No," I said. "This wasn't happening. It couldn't be." "You tricked me, Celine." The shadow laughed again. "I tried to warn you, but you didn't listen." The shape floated upwards, severing itself from its earthly body. "Enjoy your eternity, James." Then it was gone, becoming one with the babbling horde of dead souls. I fell to the ground. The earth I knew was slipping away. The car behind me faded. Celine's broken body flickered out like a candle flame. Even the grass beneath my feet degenerated into an uncertain fog. Forever, I thought. Forever trapped in this rotted body, surrounded by the black tendrils of the dead. I raised my head. But surely there was some hope. Surely there was more of Osiris's blood somewhere that someone could drink and replace me as I had replaced a legend. Surely somewhere. I stood resolute. I would just have to wait, that was all. I could wait. With renewed purpose, I went forth to survey my kingdom, hemmed in on all sides by the laughing, damnable shades.